Russians rely on smartphone apps like WhatsApp and Telegram. The Kremlin is blocking their use.
They are in the business, like a lot of authoritarian regimes, of imagining and fighting threats where they don't necessarily exist.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, we take you to Bangladesh. Today's election there is a crucial one, especially for young people who led the protests that toppled the previous government.
Are you excited? Yes, very much.
And in Britain, for criminal defendants who also happen to be musicians, prosecutors can use their song lyrics against them at trial.
That's not facts. That's false. You know what I'm saying? It's just art. It's music. It never happened. How could you use that in court?
There's now an effort to change that policy. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Voters in Bangladesh went to the polls today in the first election since longtime Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina was ousted from office in August of 2024. Voters hope it will be the first free and fair election in more than a decade. It is one of the most consequential in Bangladesh's 55-year history. The World's Carolyn Beeler has been reporting in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. Carolyn, what is it like there today?
Dhaka feels pretty festive today, actually. It is the first contested election in many years, and people are excited to vote. That includes the current interim leader of Bangladesh, Mohammed Yunus. I was outside of his polling station after he voted this morning and asked him about the significance of today. He called it the birthday of a new Bangladesh.
Fantastic. We have a big future coming up. We are just creating new Bangladesh. Bangladesh
2.0. So what are you hearing from other voters, Carolyn, besides this very high-profile one, Mohammed Yunus?
So at the polls I visited today, people told me they were most concerned about some really basic stuff, restoring democracy, improving the economy, ensuring basic human rights. And there were a lot of first-time voters, like Nahid Sharma Niti, who was waiting in line at a polling station in a kind of commercial area of Dhaka today.
How old are you?
31.
And this is your first time voting?
Yes.
She says she didn't feel safe voting under the last government, but now she wants to cast her ballot for progress.
Are you excited?
Yes, very much.
That's kind of the reaction I got from several people today.
Well, you described the mood earlier as festive, Carolyn, and it does sound like people are really excited about this moment. We should recall, though, that the overthrow of Sheikh Hasina was pretty violent, with hundreds of protesters killed by security forces before she was forced to flee. What is the security situation like now on election day?
Tensions were pretty high leading up to today's election, and security forces were everywhere. Mounted police units and these like army trucks full of soldiers were on the streets and at every polling location I went to. So far, local media and the political parties themselves are reporting some minor clashes between supporters of different parties, but there's no widespread confirmed violence.
So who or what parties are people voting for today? Who's looking likely to take power?
Today, people actually voted for members of parliament and on a constitutional referendum that would pave the way for some reforms suggested by the student protest movement. But there is a lot more attention on the parliamentary elections. And despite this being an election of change, Marco, it is two traditional legacy parties expected to take most of the votes.
Yeah, so tell us more about those two parties.
So first is the Bangladesh Nationalist Party. It is projected by most polls to get the most votes today. It's a center-right party that was for many years the main opposition party to Sheikh Hasina's Awami League. Its chairman is Tariq Rahman, who had been in self-imposed exile for the past 17 years. He returned actually just recently to run in this election, and I was in the room when he cast his ballot today.
The likely future prime minister of Bangladesh is casting his ballot right now with dozens and dozens of journalists pushing and shoving to get close to him. This shows you the historic nature of this vote.
So Rahman and the BNP are vying for votes against a coalition led by an Islamist party on the right, Jamaat Islami. That party was banned under the former government, but it has been growing in popularity for the past many years.
Wow, that was really dramatic, that casting of ballots there. These elections would not be happening if the previous repressive government of Sheikh Hasina had not been toppled by massive protests in 2024. recalling that those demonstrations were led by young people, many of them students. Carolyn, how are those young people feeling today?
So that is what I came to Bangladesh to find out, actually. Gen Z protests are happening in many countries, and I wanted to see what happens next after a major protest movement is successful, if they could translate their protests into real political change. So ahead of the voting today, I met with students involved in the protest movement to hear what they're thinking now about the state of democracy in Bangladesh. Those protests that would eventually spread nationwide began here at the University of Dhaka, actually at the intersection where I am standing right now with a student protester who was there starting at the very beginning, Zaid Ekram.
I was there during those times. There was tear gas flying, and the police were with batons beating up the protesters. I took one of my friends to hospital.
Up to 1,400 people were killed by security forces during those protests. But Ekram didn't ask me to meet him here to talk about that. He wants to point out the low cement wall behind us.
The walls here were previously used only by the ruling party to write basically slogans of their party.
Now they're covered in bright red graffiti spelling out the previous government's crimes, rigging elections, killing protesters, ignoring constitutional protections.
So the fact that we're able to highlight the atrocities or human rights violations committed by previous regimes, I thought that it'd be quite symbolic to stand in front of this.
This graffiti to you represents that free speech and ability to criticize the government has returned to Bangladesh.
Yeah, and I think it's very pivotal for any democracy to be able to talk against the government.
Or right now, the political parties vying for power. Ekram is a tall 22-year-old whose words almost can't keep pace with his enthusiasm. He isn't ready to say that the work of the July Revolution, as it's called here, is quite done.
But the fact that we're being able to debate different political ideologies or different parties, that itself, and the environment of a free and fair election, that is what I prize the most after this July Revolution.
Today, Ekram is hoping to see that constitutional referendum on the ballot pass. That would pave the way for reforms like term limits on prime ministers and strengthened powers for the president. And he's focusing on law school. Eventually, he wants to help build up Bangladesh's system of checks and balances. Other members of the Gen Z protest generation are running for office, trying to translate the ideals of their movement into political change.
We hope for Bangladesh equality and justice and truly democratic Bangladesh.
Mohammed Nasruddin Patwari is 30 and wearing a crisp white traditional tunic. He was on the ballot today in Dhaka. I met him a few days ago in the office of an online media startup.
You can sit here. It will be 10 minutes after the 10 minutes.
You're a very busy man. I think you were grabbing lunch when I walked in, and now you're off to another interview.
I'm not busy man, just we are newcomer in the election process, so lots of things we have to do, manage.
Patwari was a student protester, and he helped start a political party out of that movement. The National Citizen Party is trying to break into a political system he says is controlled by monetary power and muscle power.
In our political culture, who has the muscle power, they can buy vote. So that's our roadblock to democratic Bangladesh.
Another roadblock, his new party was founded only a year ago.
It was not enough time to form a political party countrywide.
So ahead of the elections, the National Citizen Party joined an 11-party coalition with the Islamist party, Jamaat Islami. That alienated many women in the NCP who feared losing some of their rights. Some female candidates running for office dropped out of the party. But Patwari defends the decision to join that coalition as a purely pragmatic move.
We will prove that we are pro-women, we are pro-young generation, and Jamaat Islami's ideology is different. It's just an electoral alliance.
So for people who are afraid or disappointed, you're saying just wait and see how we govern?
Yes.
Govern was probably a generous term there. The NCP has only 27 candidates running for seats in parliament out of nearly 2,000, and only a handful of those stand a chance of winning. Many Gen Z protesters had hoped for more. That includes University of Dhaka student Naushin Mushtari.
Everyone was very excited that a new Bangladesh, and after 15 years of this bad thing, and we got a new Bangladesh.
When she got word that the Hasina government was finished, Mushtari went out into the street to celebrate.
My mother was also in the road, my sister, my aunt, everyone was on the road. We saw hope.
Mushtari, who's 24 and studying journalism, was on campus to hand in a paper. In Bengali, she tells me she hoped that her generation could move away from the status quo, cycles of military rule and strong-arm leaders. Since we're a new generation, we wanted something new, she says. Fast forward a year and a half, and two legacy parties now look set to win the lion's share of votes in this election. The son of a former prime minister is favored to be the next prime minister. There was a chance for something different, she says. Now I feel like that possibility has been pushed back another 15 to 20 years.
Do you think the revolution has failed?
No, I don't think it failed totally.
Is it a work in progress?
Yeah, definitely.
Naushin Mushtari speaking with the world's Carolyn Beeler in Dhaka, Bangladesh's capital. Carolyn is back with me now. So when are we going to have some results from today's election?
They're expected to come out within the next couple of days. And I want to point out here, Marco, that Gen Z makes up nearly a third of the registered voters here. So even if younger candidates don't make it into parliament, Gen Z will absolutely play a role in who does.
Well, you will be back with us reporting from Dhaka on the results of this historic election in Bangladesh. Carolyn Beeler, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
In sports news, two stories we want to tell you about. The International Olympics Committee banned a Ukrainian athlete from the skeleton event today in Italy. Skeleton is like the luge, but riders descend head first, not feet first. Vladislav Haraskevich insisted on wearing a helmet that showed the faces of 24 Ukrainian athletes killed by Russia in the war back home.
Some of them were kids who never be able to compete anymore, and some of them was also part of this Olympic family.
This is Haraskevich speaking on Tuesday to Ireland's RTE television. The IOC said the images on Haraskevich's helmet violate a ban on political messages on uniforms. It offered Haraskevich an alternative, saying he could wear a black armband, to which he replied on CNN.
I believe IOC doesn't have enough black bands to memorize all the athletes who was killed in this war.
So Haraskevich was disqualified. In soccer, the dream of a Super League of Europe's best soccer teams has finally come to an end. 5 years ago, 12 teams announced a breakaway bid, but loud protests quickly ensued from European soccer officials, fans, and clubs snubbed by the scheme. The Super League never got off the ground. But two teams held out hope, football clubs Barcelona and Real Madrid. Speaking to club officials in Madrid back in 2023, Madrid's president Florentino Perez defended the Super League. The objective of the Super League is clear, he said, to offer the best soccer competition possible. The clubs must control their own destiny, he said. And this week, that destiny came to an end. On Saturday, Barcelona threw in the towel, leaving Madrid the last club standing. Today, Madrid agreed to scrap the league, as long as European football and financiers dropped any legal action against the club. The president of UEFA, the Union of European Football Associations, Alexander Seferin, expressed relief.
Honestly speaking, we were all tired of these disputes.
European soccer fans were tired, too. They argued there's already a great league, the Champions League and its 36 teams. This year so far, Madrid is in ninth place. Ahead on the show, a video game sends players on an art heist. They're stealing African artifacts from Western museums, or are they returning the objects to their rightful owners? Wrestling with that question is just part of the game. We'll hear from the creator of Relooted in just a moment. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We're in a video game set in an art museum at night, playing a character named Nomali, who has just spotted a lavish crown through her binoculars.
We're here for one reason. to get back what was taken.
We're here for one reason, to get back what was taken. Welcome to Re-Looted, a new game that asks players to reclaim African cultural heritage, and the artifacts depicted in the game are real, though the museums players navigate do not correspond to real institutions.
Stop, intruder!
I'm a visitor.
Oh, really? Please, enjoy the museum.
Got it.
It's time to get out of here.
In the trailer for the game, a question comes up on the screen in big block letters. Is it stealing to take back what was stolen? Ben Myers is the creative director for Re-Looted. He's also the lead designer and co-founder of the South African game studio, Nyamakop. When we caught up with him today, he said that the game was inspired by a trip his mom took to the British Museum in London.
I came to dinner and just saw my mother, who was incensed with rage. She had just seen something called the Nirad Monument, which is an ancient Lycian tomb from the south of Turkey. And it's basically a small building that had been dismantled almost brick by brick and moved a few thousand kilometers and reconstructed inside the British Museum. And I think she was just sort of struck with the audacity of stealing a building, essentially. And so she very flippantly said, oh, you should make a game about bringing this back to where it belongs. And I could never really figure out how to make moving a building out of another building very fun. So very quickly moved to African artifacts, which has been a conversation on the continent for a very long time. But yes, as all great ideas are, they came from my mother. So yeah.
Credit to your mother. So who are the main avatars in Re-Looted, and what's motivating them and the players playing them?
All the characters in the game are not career criminals. They all have normal everyday jobs in Africa. And so the character the players control is called Nomali, and she's a sports scientist, South African, but based in Tanzania. The game starts with her having to help her delinquent security systems brother out of some trouble. She does that and then comes back to Johannesburg for the first time in a long time. She goes to the park where her professor grandmother, Prof. Grace, says, well, we should heist some artifacts. And Nomali's like, what are you talking about? And then she sort of goes into the conceit of the game, which is a treaty that has been signed between essentially the African Union and the rest of the world, which says all artifacts on public display need to be returned back to the places they were taken from. However, that sort of loophole of public display is abused. And so museums start only exhibiting things in private. And so Professor Grace, who spent her entire career trying to get these artifacts back, quote unquote, the right way, says there's no ways. There's at least this list of artifacts we have to bring home.
Now, the plunder of cultural heritage, especially in Africa, it's a potent topic for a lot of people across the world, has motivated activists like Congolese Emery Mwazulu, who said he went to a Paris museum and was arrested after symbolically trying to reclaim a 19th century Chadian wooden funerary post. Did people like him inspire you and the characters in this game?
Through the development and research of the game, we came across stories like the one you just mentioned. And that fellow, actually, we used as one of the bases for one of the characters in the game. And I think what we realized very quickly is, as much as there are these activists and there are people working on this issue, it's not a mainstream, widely known topic and issue. And so what we're hoping and loving to do with this game is make it accessible to or known about to a much wider audience, because there are people doing the actual work of African artifact restitution. We're just game developers. We do entertainment. We're just trying to entertain and increase people's awareness of this rather than doing the actual hard paperwork, of which there is a lot when it comes to African restitution.
So what is the sort of conversation you hope this game will spark among people who play it, who might not be that well attuned to what's happening with cultural patrimony?
For us, we see it as a first step to learning about African culture and ethnicities and history. Like, each of these artifacts is so interesting and so fascinating that we hope people play it and be like, well, this artifact can't be real. And then they Google it or whatever, and they're like, oh my days, this is a real thing. And it might be near them as well. And so I think we always see this as an invitation to learn about the continent in a way that maybe not many people know. And then the second thing is obviously awareness of, like, when you see an artifact like this in a museum, it might have been dubiously acquired. And so viewing these artifacts in a museum or on display is not a passive exercise. There's a question you can ask about, how did this get here and why is it here? And so every artifact in the game, we don't really force this down players' throat, but we sort of present them the facts and the history of what this artifact meant and how it was taken. And then we sort of leave them with the lingering question, do you think this should have been taken? And we let them answer the question without answering it for them.
There's been so much publicity around the Benin bronzes and the impact of plunder on former colonies in West Africa. What does the reception you've seen so far to Relooted tell us about the continent-wide concern over stolen cultural heritage?
None of it is new to Africans. Africans know these things, right? They know about the heritage that's been taken. So I think African gamers are excited about it, but the actual people doing the restitution work are sort of like, oh yeah, we know all of this. That's cool that there's a video game, but we're aware of this work.
Are you hoping that the very title Relooted, which says a lot in itself, will attract attention outside of Africa?
It was a very difficult game to name for a lot of reasons. And the prefix re can mean to undo or to do again. And so we loved a little bit of a play on words because the museums in the game are essentially looting the artifacts again, but the team is trying to unloot them. And oftentimes when these artifacts were taken, they were actually referred to as the loot at the time they were taken. In the British Museum, next to the Benin bronzes in the British Museum, there is a photo of that exhibition, and it is captioned, I might be paraphrasing, the loot. So like this phrase of loot has actually been used in relation to African cultural heritage for a very, very long time.
So Relooted as a game was well underway when the Louvre heist happened. A thief stole $102 million worth of jewels, as we can recall. Did the mechanics of that caper influence your game design in any way?
It did not. I was very annoyed when that heist happened, because if we'd known you just needed a ladder, it would have been a lot simpler game to design, to be honest. And I think we've generally had a pretty good response from museum workers who like get the idea of the game. But the one criticism museum workers have when they see Relooted is, what's the budget for this museum security system? Because we apparently have the most advanced security systems that museums would never dare to have. But I think the Louvre heist is a great example. I've managed to see some of the artifacts in our game in the museums they're in real life. And it is funny how easy it would be probably to take those artifacts if you really wanted to. And in the game, we're just drastically overcomplicating the whole thing. So it was quite funny when we have this like 40-step level to get one of these artifacts. And then in real life, just a crane or a ladder would have done most of the trick.
Go down to Home Depot and you're set.
Exactly.
Ben Myers is the creative director for Relooted, a new South African video game. Why Olympic medals have been crashing to the ground and breaking, that's just ahead here with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Certain musical artists, when they've been charged with a crime, occasionally prosecutors have used their own songs against them in court, arguing in some cases that the lyrics are evidence of wrongdoing or even criminal intent. Now advocates are pushing legislation that would limit the use of lyrics or music videos as evidence in court. Dozens of artists and legal experts say the practice has unfairly targeted young black men. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
I'm a big bad wolf. Big bad wolf.
Giggs, a rapper from South London, is one of the artists campaigning against song lyrics being used as evidence in court.
Evidence in court should be 100% facts. 100% facts. Rap music or art is not always 100% facts.
Giggs has had his own run-ins with police. In 2012, he was remanded in custody after a semi-automatic weapon was found in the boot of a car he was travelling in. His friend admitted to possession, but Giggs was still charged. And in the trial, he said recently on social media, lyrics from his song Wolf were brought up as evidence that he was violent and likely owned a gun. In particular, one line where he raps about turning someone into a corpse.
Someone gave me that lyric and I put it in my song. That's not facts. That's false. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just art. It's music. It rhymed with I'm a big bad wolf and I put it in the song. It never happened. How could you use that in court?
Giggs was acquitted, but some legal experts say incidences like this are happening more and more often in British courts.
We do know that it is happening at scale based on our experience and knowledge from lawyers, expert witnesses and so on. And we do know that the number of cases has been increasing.
Abena Owosu-Bempah is an associate professor of criminal law at the London School of Economics. In some cases, she says, the suspect isn't even performing the songs that are being played out as evidence in court.
Sometimes it's as much as being in a music video or having a so-called interest in drill music, which becomes part of the case.
Drill music, which originated in Chicago around 2010, is popular in particular in deprived parts of London and Manchester. It's a dark, bass-heavy form of rap. The lyrics often deal with drugs and gang violence. And prosecutors often present those songs as essentially diaries of what an artist has done. London's police have regularly ordered drill videos to be taken down.
These videos are a catalyst for violence, and YouTube should be doing more to get rid of them to stop that catalyst happening.
Former police chief superintendent Dal Babu said the videos glamorise gang violence.
It's a massive lack of understanding of a lot of these young people are living within violence every day in their communities and where they live.
Ellie Brazil is co-founder of the group Art Not Evidence. She's behind the campaign demanding that music videos be limited as a form of evidence in court.
You know, it doesn't have to be they've committed or experienced violence, but they're seeing it around them, their friends, their family. You know, a lot of these young people are using it for therapy. So we're criminalising them and highlighting something that you're experiencing violence in your everyday life is not equal to glamorising.
Britain's Crown Prosecution Service has said it never prosecuted anybody solely on the basis of their involvement with drill or rap music. And some artists have famously rapped about their crimes, like US rapper TK. I'm the TK, I don't think you want no action. You want action, you get turned into passing. Your boy's deep, well, let's get to subtracting. TK recorded his best known song, The Race, while he was on the run from police, after being charged with murder and aggravated robbery. In the song's video, he stands in front of his own wanted poster, waving a gun at the camera. Prosecutors played out the full video in court as part evidence of his involvement in the crime, along with witness testimony and forensic analysis. The rapper was sentenced to 55 years. Ellie Brazel says her campaign isn't about banning all music videos or lyrics from being used as evidence in court.
Our legislation, it is not like a blanket ban. It would not stop any of those cases. I guess rare cases, but cases where someone has directly confessed to a crime or it relates to a lyric relates to real evidence that the police actually have. What we want would never stop that from being able to be used as evidence.
Last night, lawmakers debated Brazel's proposal in the House of Lords. Baroness Chakrabarty said young black men and boys were being increasingly targeted for their enjoyment of rap and drill music.
Even more outrageous, there are groups and units of mostly middle-aged white police officers who hold themselves out as expert witnesses to translate this music and these lyrics and the patois for juries.
Even if the proposal is passed by both houses of parliament, it'll be some time yet before it's turned into law. In the meantime, campaigner Ellie Brazel says she hopes that police and prosecutors will think twice before using art to prove an offence. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Starting today, Russia is blocking WhatsApp. The Kremlin is encouraging the Russian public to instead use the government's national messenger. Meta, the parent company that owns WhatsApp, says this is a backwards move that would, quote, isolate over 100 million users from private and secure communication, end quote. The Kremlin says WhatsApp was failing to comply with government regulations. Earlier this week, Russia restricted access to another popular social media platform, Telegram. Sam Green knows these apps well. He's a professor at King's College. As an expert on Russian politics, he relies on smartphone apps to keep up with events inside the country. Green says the new restrictions are, for the Russian government, about control and surveillance.
And it's been moving now for a number of years to really try to narrow the space that it can't see and to narrow the space that it can't control, right, in which Russians are communicating. I mean, I think that the interesting thing is there's no real indication that either of these apps are posing a real threat, right, to the ability of the regime to stay in power to fight his war in Ukraine, right? But they are in the business, like a lot of authoritarian regimes, of imagining and fighting threats where they don't necessarily exist.
Perhaps more surprising is the Kremlin banning the Telegram app. It's used by a lot of people in Russia. I mean, when I went there in 2019, I was ready with it loaded up on my phone. Why are we seeing the use of that app restricted too? Same reason?
Well, in some ways, Telegram is a little bit more sort of interesting and problematic for the Kremlin, because unlike WhatsApp, which is primarily used sort of for person-to-person communication, although there's chat groups and that sort of things as well, Telegram, has a social media component to it and almost a mass media component to it. It is increasingly the way that many Russians are getting their news, particularly young Russians, really anybody under the age of sort of 35 or 40, and particularly if they want news that isn't exactly what they're getting off of state propaganda or state television. So even people who aren't necessarily minded to oppose the Kremlin or oppose what it's doing in Ukraine, if they want honest figures about what the state of affairs is on the front line, how many people are dying in the war, they really don't have much choice other than to go to places like Telegram. It's also something that a lot of the independent media and the exiled media have used to sort of get around censorship of traditional websites and those sorts of media, right? So it is more challenging, right? But it's also relied on by a lot of people. And so a lot of people who, again, are not generally minded to oppose the Kremlin are going to find that this is making their lives more difficult.
So Telegram was founded by Pavel Durov, who's from Russia. The company's now based in Dubai, and Durov is saying that, quote, Russia is restricting access to Telegram to force its citizens onto a state-controlled app built for surveillance and political censorship. How accurate is that?
It's pretty accurate, right? I mean, you mentioned at the outset of this app, Max, right? This is something that was developed in order to give people a replacement.
Max Messenger, right?
Exactly, right? To give people a replacement for WhatsApp and Telegram. It has a lot of the same functionality, of course, without the encryption. And while the government has said, look, we're not going to be looking over your shoulder, not a lot of people necessarily believe that, right? So a lot of people are, reluctant to get on that app. They've been looking for other sorts of again, encrypted communications. The state has been trying to close down on those as well, right? So, I think that Durov is probably right about that.
What do you know about the actual capabilities of this official government app, Max Messenger?
Well, I haven't had the occasion to use it. Nobody that I want to talk to in Russia wants to use that app.
Okay.
And so, I can't say how the user experience compares to something like Telegram or WhatsApp, except to say that, it's advertised as being able to do more or less exactly the same thing. Of course, the real problem is that if you are, already in communities or in communication with individuals or groups of people on one of these other apps like WhatsApp or Telegram, right, then moving to Max is difficult because your community doesn't necessarily move with you. You have to start again. It's why these sorts of social media and communication apps are sticky and why it's hard for people to quit them. That's true in Russia as it is everywhere else.
It makes me wonder, if Russia wants to keep more control over the information space, why not just cut off access to the internet entirely like we saw in Iran?
Well, again, the internet really has become integrated into people's lives. I mean, first of all, the vast majority of people do on the internet isn't politically relevant. People are watching cute cats and baby videos and right. Engaging with AI. And so you run the risk of really ticking off all of the people who just wanted to see the cute cats, right? But also, it's a large part of the way the economy functions, particularly in major cities. People are going online to do all the things that we do in Western cities to get groceries and food delivered, right, to order, to communicate, to run their lives. It's the way a lot of business functions, right? So the costs of doing that would be really quite tremendous and really unpredictable. So it's something the government has not wanted to do. It's tried to create alternative platforms to which it would have access and which it would be able to control. But Russians, not for no reason, are among the biggest users of VPNs in the world, because even if they're not minded to go out and protest against the government, it doesn't mean that they trust it.
I'm speaking with Sam Green, professor of Russian politics at King's College London, about the banning of WhatsApp and Telegram, the apps in Russia. What is the political price Putin and his allies could pay for banning the very popular Telegram app?
Well, I think the biggest price is that they've become a nuisance to people. They've really tried very hard to keep this war and all of the politics and repression associated with the war away from the lives of ordinary people, right? So you know where the red lines and the boundaries are, but as long as you stay on the right sides of those boundaries, you can try to go about your life more or less normally, particularly if you're sort of the middle class, upper middle class, living in Moscow, St. Petersburg, Russia's other large cities. You can kind of pretend that none of this is happening. When all of a sudden the stuff that's kind of the fiber of your life, right, what you get online, begins to disappear, then it's much harder to pretend that none of this is happening, and that annoyance can compound, right? It often tends to be sort of the banalities that really create challenges for authoritarian regimes, not the big picture political stuff.
For some time, YouTube and the Alexei Navalny investigations that he would put up there before he was killed, that served as social media in Russia. How active is that channel today?
Well, I mean, YouTube and the channels associated with Navalny and his team remain active. There is a lot of independent media in general that goes out into Russia through YouTube. Again, this is another one of those situations where the government finds itself in a little bit of a bind. They would love to get rid of it, and they've tried to block certain channels. It's difficult to do. YouTube makes it difficult for them to do that. But it is, if you really wanted to pull it down, again, you're going to risk angering lots and lots of people who are watching pretty innocuous content. On YouTube, they've tried to build sort of Russian alternatives to it. They haven't been terribly successful, right? So they do find themselves, trying to figure out what's the greater evil here, allowing some of this content to seep in or risking really annoying tens or more millions of people who are just trying, as I said, to watch cute cats.
Sam, beyond the social media apps that we've been talking about, generally, how restricted and monitored is the internet today in Russia?
It's not Iran, right? It's not China. There is still a lot more room for people to communicate without some degree of surveillance. It's not quite as locked, although it's a whole lot more restricted than it was before the full-scale war in Ukraine started in 2022. I think what has happened, though, is that people have begun to feel that there is somebody looking over their shoulders. And we have increasing numbers of cases, hundreds, in some cases, thousands of cases of individuals being prosecuted, given fines, in some cases going to jail, right, for messages that they've posted to WhatsApp or things that they've posted on other social media, right? Even just sort of obliquely questioning what the government is doing in the war, to say nothing of openly questioning it. And so that is creating a damper on people's communications, not just online, but what they say to each other at work or out in their social lives. People have a sense that there's just some conversations that you shouldn't have.
You're a close observer of Russian politics, Sam, so no doubt this is going to impact your ability to keep tabs on what's happening in Russia. But practically, what does it mean for you in pinning down other sources?
Telegram disappears. It'll be a problem. It's a way that I am able to get news to see sort of a broader swathe of what's happening. A lot of, in fact, of what we know about what goes on the war, because a lot of the military bloggers are posting their information on Telegram. So a lot of what we know comes to us that way. Of course, people have seen this coming for a while. And so a lot of the sorts of people that do that, or that people like me, that the researchers like me talk to on a regular basis, have been migrating and hopping from app to app. My phone is full of these things now as people sort of try to find the places that they feel comfortable talking to people like me. So we'll adapt. I think it would become much more difficult if we ended up in a situation like Iran where simply nothing is getting in or out. But I think the government for the time being will be reluctant to do that.
Sam Green is a professor of Russian politics at King's College London. Not many of us can say we've had this experience. You're hanging with your pals, celebrating your recent Olympic gold medal win, when suddenly the medal comes off the ribbon around your neck, hits the ground, and breaks. This really happened to German biathlete Justus Strelow, as you just heard there from a clip posted on social media. He's actually not alone. This has been an issue at these games. Here's Andrea Francesi, an Italian official with the Olympics.
Siamo a conoscenza.
We are fully aware of the situation, and you saw yourselves the pictures. We are looking to exactly what the problem is, and obviously this is something where everything is perfect when the medal was handed over, as this is probably one of the most important moments for the athletes.
davvero il momento più.
So we are working on it.
Apparently, the problem centers on the lanyards the medals are attached to. They're fitted with a breakaway mechanism required by the games, designed to prevent the medalist from ever being choked. Okay, well, until the mystery of the malfunctioning medals is fully resolved and dealt with, here's some medal etiquette advice from American downhill skiing champion Breezy Johnson.
Don't jump in them. I was jumping in excitement and it broke. I'm sure somebody will fix it. It's not like crazy broken, but it's a little broken.
The National Mint in Italy says it is ready as needed to repair any fallen medals. As you heard, Italian officials say they're also working on a solution. A side note, more than 100 athletes from the 2024 Paris Games had to have their medals replaced after they showed signs of deterioration in less than a year. You could say all these winners demonstrate great mettle. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. When people fleeing conflict are displaced, that doesn't just affect them. It shapes the experiences of generations to come. Being forced to leave home shapes the lives of their children, even their grandchildren. That's the case for rapper Ana Tijoux. She was born to Chilean exiles in France, and she doesn't feel completely at home in any one country. That's something she's been working through as an artist, but even more so as a mother. Ana Tijoux spoke about all of this with Maclete Hadero on the Movement podcast about music and migration. Here's Maclete with that.
The day Ana's daughter was born, there was no question. She'd be named Emilia after Ana's mother, Maria Emilia Tijoux. As a college student in Chile, Maria Emilia was involved in the revolutionary left movement known as MIR. By 1970, Salvador Allende had become the first democratically elected Marxist leader in Latin American history. But things quickly took a violent turn. On September 11, 1973, Chile was forced into a military dictatorship under General Augusto Pinochet. Targeted by the regime with violence, Ana's parents managed to escape to France. And a few years later, Ana was born.
In my home, they never teach me to say, don't ask that, it's about adults. Never. So they put me, they make me part of those reflections, obviously with a language for kids.
And alongside those conversations, the question of Chile lingered in Ana's head.
I was feeling this curiosity about that country that I didn't really know that was Chile.
In the early 1990s, Ana's family returned to Chile once Pinochet was ousted from power. And it was in Chile where Ana picked up rapping. As a teen, she joined a politically conscious hip-hop group. Then she went solo to international acclaim. Her 2010 album, 1977, a raw bilingual self-portrait, landed her at South by Southwest. Her next two albums, La Bala and Vengo, earned Grammy nominations. But despite mainstream recognition, Ana's voice remained rooted in revolution.
Everything is political. I always say this, and perhaps I'm super bold in saying this, but they wanted to teach us to put political stuff away from our life. And that's for a reason also. And I think it's very convenient. Perhaps we become more dangerous when we have more the capacity of analizar to have an opinion about what is going on around the world.
At the height of Ana's fame, it felt like the world was at an inflection point. La Bala came out around the time of Occupy Wall Street, the Arab Spring, and student-led movements in Chile. Ana offered her powerful critique of patriarchy, state violence, and colonialism, rapping about environmental justice, indigenous sovereignty, and the rights of women. But she found herself at odds with the profit-driven music industry. And with more visibility came more expectation.
it was complicated for me at least to make music for all that expectation, too much expectation. I don't know if I can fit to all the expectation. I don't want to be there. I did never ask about that. And now you get to be in another step and be bigger and bigger and stronger and beautiful and younger. And it's like...
She felt like the very passion that had led her to music was eclipsed by stress.
I don't know where to go creatively. I don't know, because I was feeling lost.
9 years went by without a new album. At first, Anna felt stuck. But those feelings eased when she found herself writing again. This time, not an album, but an autobiography, filled with poetry. Writing helped her process her deepest grief, like the death of her sister, Tanya. Once again, creativity flowed. A year after her memoir, Anna released her fifth studio album, Vida, her most joyful and celebratory project yet. These days, Anna is embracing the freedom and the play that drew her to hip-hop in the first place, alongside her friend and longtime producer, Eduardo.
And I said, you know what, Eduardo? Let's do hip-hop and have fun. So we make the boom bap. I say, I like that beat. Okay, let's do it. At the same time, say, you know what? Try to take out that expectation. Just do it. Like, it was complicated for me at least to make music for all that expectation, too much expectation. I don't know if I can fit. Let me be old and tired and laugh a lot. So that's the way that we made this EP. Like, I think it has been the cure of my stress.
This is a very spiritual perspective.
I'm a mother. We need to continue to live, like, and we get this privilege right now. Like, I would say this, like, my parents, I will not enter in details, but my parents live terrible stuff. And they always talk to me about the stuff that are very, como, I will not say happy, but the joke that was happening at that time and during the dictatorship, all the stupid stuff that nobody talk. And it was full of joy when they was in prison. Like, they was laughing a lot. And I say, wow, how people that can live that kind of brutality can have that joy, you know? And I think the joy is something that nobody can break. Mm. It's part of the, I would say, the necessity as a human being to continue to live. Like, every day I've got to wake up my daughter, go to school, life continue, and I've got to give her hope.
That's right.
That we can make a different world. And for that, she need me also with joy. It's hard, but it's something that we get to find. Because if not, it's not a life. And we love this life.
And we love this life.
With all the contradictions.
In 2025, Anna released her EP, Serpiente de Madera. You can find it wherever you listen to music.
Maclet Hedero spoke with Anna Tijoux for the podcast Movement. Look for it wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find stories about music and migration, including a longer version of this story. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and also on YouTube. Most of our original reporting is there. Be sure to subscribe as well. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.